Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 15th, 2015, and please let the record show we do have a quorum. Members, thank you for being here today. We do have a late bill that we need to process. It's Senate File 2056 relating to workers' compensation. I'd like to go ahead and bring that up first, and then we also have a commissioner confirmation, and then we're going to get an update from the Department of Ag, but it should be able to move along rather smoothly, hopefully. I'm going to let Senator Deems chair the committee and we'll go from there.
Next, we'll have Senator Sparks with Senate File 2056.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As I mentioned, Senate File 2056 is a bill recommended by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council to implement the DRG reimbursement system for inpatient hospital payments. This is a big first step in addressing medical costs in the work comp system. It has taken a lot of work and tough negotiation to reach this agreement, and I would like to thank all of those who were involved in putting this together. Commissioner Ken Peterson is seated with me today. He's going to walk through the bill here in a minute, and I would like to thank him for all his leadership on this. Also, Brad Lettle from the AFL-CIO and Ben Gerber from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce are here, and they can add some comments after the commissioner walks you through the bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Commissioner Peterson.
Commissioner Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today on this bill. Senator Sparks mentioned several people. This has been an important bill. It's a big first step in helping to control costs for workers' comp medical costs. But there are two people who passed away in the last year who worked very hard on this issue over the years, and I wanted to acknowledge their contributions. They're David Olson, former president of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and Chris Iden, former deputy commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. The work of both of them helped pave the way for this agreement. I'm deeply appreciative, and I'm sorry they passed away much sooner than ordinarily. But that's, like we said, this bill is an effort to slow down the increase in hospital costs as well as to make the system more administratively more efficient. Current law says that hospitals get paid 85% of their usual and customary charges. The problem with that, there are two problems with that. One is that it's substantially higher than other payers like group health plans pay, so the insurers didn't like that. On the other hand, figuring out what usual and customary charges is open to a lot of debate, and it's caused a lot of disputes and administrative battles. The hospitals didn't like that. And so with those two issues, the parties were able to come together and work things out. Our hope is that this bill will go a long way to make the system more administratively workable, as well as to get lower the cost and, most important, make sure injured workers get the medical care they're entitled to. What it does, it's a DRG, Diagnostic Related Groups. It's a system used by Medicare. These are called MS-DRGs. What DRGs are simply Medicare every year gathers a cost of fixing up certain problems, certain diagnoses, and says what they cost to fix them up. And they assign the DRG to each hospital. So instead of using what cost the hospital incurred in fixing someone up, they'll use this DRG. And so if I have a bad shoulder and say the shoulder DRG is $25,000, that's what they'll charge. Unless there's some extreme circumstances, then they'll charge more, and I can go into that later. Inpatient hospital costs account for about 25% of total work comp medical costs. As part of this agreement, though, insurers and hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers have agreed to negotiate over the next year with the hope of coming back to the legislature next session with an agreement which would take care of the other 75%. However, we've agreed that if they don't come to an agreement, the department will proceed with rulemaking and by January 1st, 2017, come in with our own rules how to fix stuff, but they don't agree. So we think that's going to be an incentive for both sides to come to the table, and we're not envisioning too many problems except for just coming up with the right numbers. But we think we're going to be able to do that. I can quickly, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, I can quickly go through it section by section, or if you just want to take questions, I'll go with your pleasures.
Senator Sparks, how would you like to proceed?
It's up to the committee, I guess. I think that there's an agreement, but if you guys would like some more information, Commissioner Peterson is certainly qualified to give you more detail. I guess I'll leave it up to you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Why don't we open it up for questions? Does anybody on the committee have questions for Commissioner Peterson on the bill? Or would you like the sections gone through?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Weber.
I think, you know, as we review this, I think there's agreement among the people at the table. I'm certainly fine with it, but if there are those that have some issues with it, I would certainly be wishing to hear them.
Maybe, Commissioner, you could just give us a short summary of the sections on the bill. That way, if anybody has any questions, we can flush it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 1 is simply cross-reference the section. Section 2 says effective January 1st, 2016, we use the diagnosis-related groups, and so payments will no longer be based on charges. The maximum payment will be 200% of the amount paid by Medicare. So that's taken to just to recognize the fact that workers' comp costs are different than those for most Medicare patients. It uses what's called the Medicare PC pricer. The hospitals must bill the same way they do for Medicare. The bill must be submitted within 6 months via the date of the service or the date the hospital learned the identity of the insurer. Subdivision 2, this was an important issue, payment for catastrophic high-cost issues. Some work comp cases just cost an awful lot of money. This one, if a hospital's charges exceed $175,000, payment will be 75% of the hospital's usual and customary charges instead of by DRG. These type of cases, the ones that are over $175,000, account for only about 2.6% of all billings, but they account for 18% of all costs. So these are the big ones. Serious burns, amputations, that sort of thing, that cost a lot of money. And so they'll simply go ahead with the old system, except be 75% instead of 85%. And the Subdivision 3 calls for critical access hospitals. These are hospitals which are named by Medicare. They usually have rural hospitals with 25 or fewer beds, and they'll be paid 100% of their cost. These hospitals don't usually take on major issues. But maybe somebody has a broken arm or something, they'll do those sorts of things. But generally, they'll send someone on to a larger hospital, but they'll get paid at the full price. Subdivision 4 says when an insurer may not require documentation other than a standard electric bill, and then post-payment audits are allowed. But what is they can't the insurer can't allow under the when they're billed for a DRG case, they can't ask for a number of other attachments with that. So they simply have to ask what the bill is. And so the agreement is they'll just take care of it. I'll talk about that in a moment. In prompt payment requirements, when DRG payments are made, hospitals must submit electronic bill, and DRG applies, and the insurers must pay within 30 days. This has been an ongoing problem that a number hospitals claim they don't get paid soon enough, and at the same time insurers claim they are, so we're just saying 30 days and that's it. And Subdivision 6 allows for post-payment audits, allows for within 6 months an insurer to go back and ask for the entire record of what happens in certain cases. Those are cases when there's an outlier amount. That is, an outlier amount is, say a bill is $25,000, but there are some extreme circumstances, and they end up costing $75,000. So the outlier amount would be at $50,000, and it's a complicated form, which I don't go into, but they can ask for an audit then. And then the audits must be initiated within 6 months after payment. And following the audit, if the hospital has been overpaid, they have to pay it back with the O plus 4%, or if an insurance company has withheld payment, they have to pay 4%. Subdivision 7 calls for a study, analyze the impact of the reforms done by the Department of Labor and Industry by January 15, 2018. And Subdivision 8 calls for some rulemaking, for expedited rulemaking. We don't anticipate any rulemaking with this bill unless Medicare makes some changes. Then we do think there may have to be some rulemaking. If they change something around before January 1st, 2016, we'll have to do some just catch up, because we won't be able to bring it to you folks to do anything with it. We also are asking for rulemaking authority expedited rulemaking authority to go ahead with what I talked about before, to handle, to impose DRG systems on ambulatory surgical centers as well as hospital outpatients. We're hoping they can come to an agreement, and next session we'll come back to you with an agreement which you'll hopefully pass and go into law. However, if there's not an agreement, we want to have this rulemaking to sort of as an incentive. If they don't come to it, the department will just simply use the best data we have and come up with our own way of handling it. So we think that's a good incentive to bring the parties to the table. And that completes my overview, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Peterson. Members, are there any questions for Commissioner Peterson on the bill? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the one question that I do have as it relates to the expedited rulemaking is I understand that there's always the need to try and get everybody to the table and to talk about it, but I also sometimes grow concerned that the state uses it as more of a gun to the head at times, and I don't wish to see us be utilizing those type of procedures in that manner either.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber.
Commissioner Peterson.
This was part of the overall arrangement, overall agreement,
okay,
that all the parties agreed to, that thinking that no one likes the idea of forcing people to an agreement. And I think in this case, I think it would be easier to reach an agreement with these parties than it was with the hospitals, because I think the pathway is a little more clear. At the same time, what the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council and the several of the parties wanted, in order to get this done, they wanted this to be part of the overall agreement.
Okay.
Other members have questions? Hearing none at this point, Senator Sparks, would you like to have your other two testifiers come forward?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. If they'd like to come forward, they are more than welcome to do that now.
Mr. Leto and Mr. Gerber, would you like to come forward and testify? Welcome, and Mr. Leto, if you'd like to go first, state your name and your position and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Brad Leto from the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the Chief of Staff and alternate on the Workers' Comp Advisory Council for President Knutson. It's a good bill. Some of our own members actually say, well, why is this good for us? And I can't say it better than some of the employee members, labor members of the Advisory Council who said, if there's a bill that, because injured workers will get bills even though they don't have to pay them for workers' compensation, but they get them, and if this can get paid, if bills can get paid quicker from hospitals, it's a weight off of injured workers' shoulders, and they don't have to deal with that. So that quicker payment process and a cleaner payment process helps injured workers as well. So we support the bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Leto? Members have any questions? If not, Mr. Gerber, would you like to proceed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Chamber of Commerce on labor issues. I'd first like to start off by thanking the representatives from the hospitals and the insurers. They did a really great job making this come together. I know it's a little bit late in session. The last thing people want is to have another hearing, but this was the result of a lot of hard work between the two organizations. I know they're represented here, so I'd like to thank them and all their members for this deal. This was a top chamber priority. It was one of our top five for this year, and I know it was important to labor, as you heard as well. So I'd like to thank them. Also, the department, Commissioner Peterson, unfortunately, they lost one of their key staff members who battled a cancer, and they had some people that really stepped up. I know Chris Liefeld is here, so we really appreciate the hard work. There was a steep learning curve, but they all kind of pitched in, so I really do appreciate that as well. And also for the labor advocates as well for coming in at the last minute after we finally got an agreement and allowing this to go forward. We think this is a good bill. It's a result of a lot of hard work. Also, to answer the question that Senator Weber had about the the expedited rulemaking, that was a key piece. Like the commissioner said, you know, it's never ideal, but we think that we're hoping that the parties will come together and reach an agreement. We won't need rulemaking. That's the ideal situation. And so we know they're going to keep talking. The reason why we couldn't get that piece done this year is there just wasn't enough information, and we didn't want to have a bad deal. We'd rather have the deal be sound and based on sound facts. So hopefully we'll come back next year and have a bill that will deal with that as well. And that'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Any questions from the committee for the testifiers? Mr. Hickey, would you like to come forward?
Mr. Chairman, members, and Senator Sparks, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. And obviously, we're a very affected group by this law. It's 100% required mandatory insurance. And just wanted to give our support today and say thanks to everybody on the council for all their hard work on this and all their many hours. We used to serve on the council, and I had to give that spot up due to time demands. And so certainly understand the time demands of trying to serve on that council and put a deal together. We think this bill is a good start. We're very hopeful on what will be agreed to on part two, and that is outpatient. That is the big piece of the pie. We're dealing with a much smaller piece of the pie today, you realize, inpatient. And hopefully a deal will be reached, or Commissioner Peterson is going to step forward and really take some corrective action. But, you know, when you look at the history of this, you go back to 1995, benefits were the majority of cost, and we had some real serious problems there. And now health care costs are 65% of the total costs and only going upward. And so really appreciate Commissioner Peterson's desire to address this issue and everybody else's cooperation and work on this. But we're really hopeful on part two, and that's what we need to keep our eye on, is what gets agreed to or what the commissioner can achieve through this rulemaking process. And just wanted to say thanks and lend our support.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Any questions for Mr. Hickey or the other testifiers? Are there other testifiers that would like to testify either for or against the bill? Hearing none, again, did the committee members have any questions? I see no questions. Senator Sparks, would you like to give your final comments and then pass?
Thank you very much, members. Like I said, I know that we're all really busy. It's a busy time of year, but this is an important bill. It's a late bill that will have to go to the Rules Committee and then also to state and local government, but hopefully we can get it to the Senate floor, and with your cooperation, we can pass this important bill today and hopefully get it off the Senate floor yet this year. So, if there's no further questions, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 2056 be passed and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Senator Sparks has moved that Senate File 2056 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Governments. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Next, we'll have the confirmation for Commissioner Thielson of the Bureau of Mediation Services. If Commissioner Thielson would please come forward.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee, and begin your remarks whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me back for the second time to talk to you about the Bureau of Mediation Services. Now, I had the opportunity to serve 4 years as commissioner. I think everybody probably knows that this week is the celebration of the end of the Civil War, and I'm sort of a Civil War buff, and I had a hard time restraining myself from saying what Lincoln said in his second inaugural, was following 4 years of there's less occasion for an extended address than there was 4 years ago. And there isn't much new at the Bureau, but there's some important things I'd like to get a chance to tell you about. So I've got a very brief statement. I know you guys are busy. I'm really proud to have had the opportunity to be renominated by Governor Dayton and to tell you a little bit about the work of the Bureau of Mediation Services under my leadership. Today, labor management relations in Minnesota are strong and stable, which is the primary mission of the Bureau of Mediation Services. For this, most of the credit is due to labor and management leaders in Minnesota and to the hard work of the state employees that work for the State Bureau of Mediation Services, the mediators, and other staff at the Bureau. In the past 4 years, that we've resolved thousands of labor disputes involving almost all of Minnesota's public employers, many private employers, without one single strike. There's been no strikes in Minnesota in the last 4 years. The number of costly interest and grievance arbitrations have declined, and structured workplace cooperation efforts between unionized public employees and their employers have steadily increased. We've also successfully resolved hundreds of union representation claims during this same period. And as I said 4 years ago, BMS is by far the smallest cabinet-level agency in state government with a very low public profile, which is the way we like it. Yet due to our broad jurisdiction, covering as it does virtually every part of state and local government, BMS mediators have an impact that far exceeds their small numbers. An important development I want to talk about for just a moment in the last couple of years is that BMS has increasingly become the go-to place for alternative dispute resolution in intergovernmental and public policy affairs, problem-solving, facilitation, and ADR. Legislative action in 2013 revived the Bureau's Office for Collaboration and Dispute Resolution, known as the OCDR, which had been dormant since 2003. OCDR has prevented and resolved disputes and built alternative dispute resolution capacity across Minnesota. OCDR has assisted state departments, local units of government, the judicial branch, and the legislature to bring modern problem-solving and dispute resolution tools to bear on many different types of public issues. Examples include, legal standards for physical child custody, organizational development, labor management issues in higher education, liability mitigation for the League of Minnesota Cities, and disputes between private universities and their many community stakeholders. OCDR has also worked with the state judicial system to train and support, make grants to Minnesota's network of community mediation and dispute resolution organizations. These organizations use the power of volunteer mediators to address a wide array of disputes throughout the state, including police community relations, small claims courts, neighbor-to-neighbor disputes, shared parenting disputes, youth and restorative justice, and school mediation training. It's my belief that these tools and approaches could be used more widely, more effectively throughout the state. Mediation and alternative dispute resolution is a calling. It's been my calling for 30 years. It's a genuine pleasure to serve people, to help analyze problems and disputes, and to identify workable solutions and reach agreements. So with your approval, I would look forward to the opportunity to continue this work during Governor Dayton's second term. Thanks. I will hope you'll have some questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions for Commissioner Thielson at this time? Okay. Senator Coonan moves the confirmation of Josh Thielson as the Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services to the Senate floor with a recommendation to confirm. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Commissioner. And finally, I think it's important and kind of timely, members, we're going to spend just a few minutes to get an update on the avian influenza and the impacts from the Department of Agriculture, and we have a few other folks too. So with your indulgence, we'll do that. Santo Cruz from the Department of Ag is here, and if you'd like to start, Santo, and give us an update on what's going on, we would certainly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, Santo Cruz, Minnesota Department of Ag, for the record. I have with me today Dr. Beth Thompson and Dr. Trevor Ames. They will be providing updates respectively for the Board of Animal Health and the VDL, Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. And actually, they're sitting perfectly because I'm a lawyer, and Dean Ames is a vet, and Dr. Beth Thompson is both a lawyer and a vet. So don't ask me how that's possible, but it is. So we also have here, in case there are questions on any health issues or the department's incident response, we have the Department of Health, and we also have Mike Starkey from the Department of Ag, who's been spearheading our effort. He has been working around the clock on this issue. So by way of logistics, I'll give a brief update, and we'll kind of get deeper as we go. Avian influenza, or H5N2, was discovered in wild birds and poultry on the West Coast. This is called the Pacific Flyway states in December and January early this year. On March 5th, 2015, USDA Animal Plant Health Inspection Services, commonly referred to as APHIS, confirmed the presence of high-path avian influenza in a commercial turkey flock here in Minnesota in Polk County. The finding in western Minnesota was the first appearance of H5N2 strain in the Mississippi Flyway. Since then, it has been found in other states and Canada. Confirmation of the virus is done through testing of samples from a turkey flock at the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, or the VDL as we call it, and the APHIS National Veterinary Services Laboratory in Ames, Iowa. MDA is the on-call team and the supporting role for the Board of Animal Health, which is the lead agency for this crisis. Commissioner Fredrickson and Dr. Bill Hartman were notified on March 5th of the turkey flock in Polk County, suspected to have H5N2, and after confirmation from USDA APHIS, they requested activation of MDA Incident Management Team Response, or IMT. Also on March 5th of this year, four MDA IMT members and numerous Board of Animal Health employees established an incident command post at the Kandi-Ohi County Emergency Operations Center in Wilmer, Minnesota, in order to work with the producers and the affected flock. On March 27th, a turkey flock in Stearns County was announced to be high-path avian influenza positive. On March 28th, the IMT established an incident command post in Stearns County Emergency Operations Center. Following this announcement in Stearns County, more flocks tested positive in several other counties. On April 2nd, MDA Incident Command requested the incident management team from USDA, referred to as the Green Team, to come in and support the work being done here in Minnesota in response to this outbreak. On April 5th, MDA Incident Management Team transitioned to the MDA Department of Operations Center. So if you come to the first floor of our building now, you will see many fresh faces from USDA and many volunteers from the Department of Ag and certainly the Board of Animal Health running the show. The following day, the USDA Green Team arrived and work began on Monday, April 6th to coordinate and this would be Easter Monday. So this is basically from the time we requested the time they were here was about 24 to 48 hours. To coordinate the response between the Board of Animal Health, MDA, and USDA. The Green Team is staffed by 24 professional employees of USDA to support the work in various roles of the Incident Command Team. Their roles and responsibilities on the team align with their professional qualifications. The Incident Command system is the systematic tool for the command, control, and coordination of emergency response. This is what's going on at MDA right now. I don't want to get too far into the weeds here. What I would say is that I believe you all have in your packets a change item the governor has requested just this week. This is obviously very, very, very late in the session, but as you all know, this outbreak kind of jumped up and bit us very quickly in the middle of session here. So the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Ag were asked to report to the governor what our projected costs are basically from the outbreak earlier this year up until the end of this fiscal year. And the cost associated with that for both for MDA is $514,000 one-time money from now until the end of this fiscal year. And that's largely just to cover the overtime. The FTEs are already people. We're not hiring anybody. But again, you have to remember at MDA, we go off of a 40-hour work week per the union agreements, and that's what people are budgeted for to do. Right now, we're running those same employees 12 hours a day, 7 days a week out in the field. So this is just to cover the overtime costs and the cash flow problem from now until the end of the fiscal year. For the Board of Animal Health, they are working to acquire temp work to handle all of the data entry that goes along with this, which is a very important role, not just here for Minnesota, but also part of the system for USDA to really gather all of the facts necessary to get to the bottom of this outbreak. And perhaps Dr. Beth Thompson can talk a little bit more about the epidemiologists out in the field trying to figure that all out. But their costs are $379,000, again, one-time money from now until the end of this fiscal year. We are responding as quickly as we can. We are doing as much as we can. And the department, again, is serving a supporting role, and the VDL has been doing a fantastic job. They are the official lab of the Board of Animal Health. And at this time, I would turn it over to Dr. Beth Thompson.
Dr. Thompson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Beth Thompson, Assistant Director, Minnesota Board of Animal Health. We appreciate this opportunity to address this committee. Yesterday, the USDA confirmed an additional 8 affected turkey farms in Minnesota. That's bringing the total to 22, and I provided, and it's both sides of this handout for you, so you can reference that if need be. Minnesota is number one in turkey production. Prior to March of this year, we had never seen a case of this disease. Very generally, for each one of these cases, and to further explain what Mr. Cruz has been talking about, a producer may notice some neurological signs in a barn of turkeys. Going from there, they might see some increased mortality, and we've also heard reports of the flock being very quiet. The veterinarian would then take a sample, which goes over to the University of Minnesota Diagnostic Lab. If a diagnosis is positive for highly pathogenic avian influenza, the farm is then quarantined and zones are established around that farm. In the 10-kilometer zone around that farm, all of the poultry flocks are tested. That includes the backyard flocks and also the commercial facilities. And if needed, permitting processes are put into place so that poultry and poultry products can move, feed can move, all of the different items that come on and off those farms. Then going out another 10 kilometers, education is being done right now through phone calls and our folks knocking on doors and talking to people about high path avian influenza. And this is just touching on some of that data entry that needs to be done with all of the farms that are in those zones. And we now have 22 of those farms out in the state of Minnesota. The amount of work that's being done just in our office alone with all of the field staff, too, is enormous. As of today, we have 12 counties with infected farms. Including the green team that we mentioned, that's over 130 people with the Board of Animal Health, Department of Agriculture, and the United States Department of Agriculture. And certainly we are also working with our partners with the DNR and also the Department of Health. There was a mention made of the virus itself, the H5N2 virus. If you go back into mid to late 2014, this virus was found over on the coast of China down by Taiwan. And that flyway for the wild waterfowl overlaps with the flyway on the western part of the United States. And there is some thought that that's how the H5N2 virus made its way into the western United States. You probably remember hearing about those cases late 2014. And then here in 2015, we have it in the Midwest because those flyways do overlap. We now have cases in the Midwest, not only in Minnesota, but also South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, and I believe Wisconsin, too. Jeez. Under the direction of the chief epidemiologist for the United States Department of Agriculture, there is a team of epidemiologists working with our poultry veterinarians, our producers, those managers that are on those farms, and they're trying to determine how the virus, we know it's in Minnesota, the wild waterfowl is a reservoir, but trying to determine how that virus is getting into the barns. And they're working very hard on that right now. In closing, this is a tough situation for our poultry producers in this state. And on behalf of the board, we will continue to do all that we can to assist those producers.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson. Thank you for all your hard work. Obviously, this is a big issue. Any questions? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the sheet that was handed out, some of the counties, they have in the box where the county name is, there's a number. What's the significance of that number?
Okay. I don't know. Dr. Thompson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, that number, if you look at the side that down on the bottom right-hand corner, it says one of two. for example, and you see Stearns number one, that means there's more than one case in Stearns County. And if you go over a couple of boxes, it's Stearns number two. So we've designated it by the numbers in the county. So they're up to, I think it's either five or six in Stearns County.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, Doctor, what, how long does it take, like, you know, in these instances where they have been quarantined and they've disposed of the birds at that site, and I assume that means they depopulate all the barns at that site, I assume. How long does it take for that to be declared virus-free then at that point after it's disinfected and what have you?
Dr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, so the first site that we talked about in Polk County, that occurred at the end of February, beginning of March. We are just, they are depopulating. The birds are composted in the barn. We are getting to the point now where we will be doing environmental samples on that compost material that's in the barn and see whether or not we can be moving that out.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just so glad to have a hearing on this today. I've been hearing so much about this, and yet it doesn't seem to answer all my questions, and I'm sure I'm not alone. Could you tell me a little bit about, you know, several years ago, there was a huge avian flu influenza, I think in Hong Kong, and you might recall people wearing the masks, and there was quite a concern. And I don't know if that was because there was a concern that it would jump to humans. And so I just want you to reassure us about this H5N2 avian influenza and how it may or may not impact humans, and if there's any concerns that it could jump to humans, how it's different from some of the other avian flu viruses that have caused such concern.
Okay. Welcome. Did you hear Senator Nelson's question?
I did. Mr. Chair, Senators, hello. My name is Dr. Stacey Holtzbar. I'm a veterinarian with the Minnesota Department of Health. To address that issue, first of all, the role of the Minnesota Department of Health in the high-path avian influenza response is to protect human health and support the other responding agencies. In general, avian influenza viruses are spread to people through direct contact with infected birds or their environment. However, there have been no human cases of infection with this strain, the H5N2 strain, that have been detected in Minnesota or anywhere in the United States. However, some high-path avian influenza H5 viruses can infect people, so it's important to prevent infections. So what the Minnesota Department of Health is doing, we contact all poultry workers that are associated with each infected flock and evaluate them for exposures. And people who've had close, unprotected contact, so not wearing the appropriate personal protective equipment, with these infected flocks are recommended to receive an antiviral drug called Tamiflu. Poultry workers are then contacted daily for 10 days and monitored for development of respiratory symptoms. In total, 64 people have been involved in the care of 20 flocks, have been interviewed and evaluated to date. 50 of these people were advised to start taking antiviral medications as a precautionary measure, and 33 have agreed to take Tamiflu. We are working with the healthcare providers for these workers the associated companies, occupational health departments, to ensure that these providers or these individuals are getting the appropriate care.
Thank you, Doctor. Senator Nelson.
Thank you for that update. I think that's very important to know. Of the 64 people that have been evaluated who were working with infected flocks, and of those, 50 of them were advised to take antivirals. Is that based upon the fact, or like of all those 64, the personal protective equipment, is that something that the handlers would always use, or is that something that they're using now because of the outbreak of the flu? So when you talked about that they were at risk if they were not using PPE, I want to know, is this a new knew that they need to use PPE in working with the flocks, or if that's just common practice.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I believe that might be a better question. I am not a poultry veterinarian, so I don't know what the specific practices have been in the past. However, we have been, when we speak, the health department speaks to these poultry workers, we go through the list of appropriate personal protective equipment that they should be wearing.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Dr. Thompson.
Yes, generally they wouldn't be wearing, the poultry workers in the barns wouldn't be wearing the extent of personal protective equipment that the doctor just mentioned, is my understanding.
Is that helpful, Senator Nelson? Yes. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is. And so then my, as I think about now that we're thinking that this H5N2 might be in wild waterfowl, and I think the latest report I heard today was that it might just be resident in Minnesota now. It might just be part of our Minnesota environment, I guess. So then the question would be, if that were the case, then does that change how poultry workers would need to interact with poultry? Is it across the board that all should be wearing the PPE, or is it just if you think that your barns have been infected?
Doctor, would you like to go ahead?
Mr. Chairman, Senators, people are at risk when they are in contact with sick and dying birds. So we would need the recommendations for PPE are when those people are around those sick or dying birds. So we would expect. We wouldn't expect people to be wearing the full range of PPE if they have healthy animals.
Okay.
Senator Nelson.
Very last question.
No, that's all right.
Thank you so much. So of the 64 people that have been evaluated and 50 have been encouraged to take antivirals, can it spread then from person to person? So are those 50 people, can they expose other humans to this virus?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Senators, as a reminder, there have been no human cases of infection with this strain of virus of H5N2 that have been detected in Minnesota or anywhere in the United States. However, people who are at most risk when they have contact with sick and dying birds, there have rarely been instances in other high-path H5 infections, not this specific virus, where there has been very limited person-to-person transmission, usually among household members.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for that. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Thompson. Can you tell me, when you're depopulating composting inside the barn, what kind of a time frame does that take?
Dr. Thompson.
Process?
Mr. Chair, Senator, The time frame for the depopulation is as soon as possible after a diagnosis within a few days. It's getting difficult because not that many keeping everything organized so that we can have that depopulation unit out there as soon as possible as we get more farms. But we are certainly doing that within a few days of diagnosis. And then the composting process, as I mentioned before, on that Pope County case that was diagnosed early March, we are just moving into the process now where we can start testing the composting product and making sure that there's no virus there and then moving it out of the barn. Okay. So we're looking at just about 6 weeks for that barn. It may vary from barn to barn.
A follow-up, Mr.
Senator,
Chair.
Yep.
Dr. Thompson, hopefully it is successful. But what kind of steps or procedures will need to be followed if it's not successful and you still have some of the viruses in the compost?
Dr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the composting process, of course, is that heating process that everything comes up to at least 140 degrees. We have composting experts both here in the state of Minnesota and also being brought in by USDA. So depending on the situation, whether it needs more water, whether it needs to be turned, all of those are being taken a look at.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Senator, Dr. Thompson, so you're confident the process is going to work. It's just a matter of what ingredients you need to make it work. I'm hearing, you know, if it needs more water or whatever to get the heat to the point where you want it, is that kind of what?
Dr. Thompson?
And Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. Yes, okay. The process will work.
Okay. Thank you. One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Dr. Thompson, can you give us some idea, once that process has been successful, the barn's been cleaned out, how long will it be then before they can restock that with birds?
Good question. Senator Thompson, or Dr. Thompson, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Senator, state of Minnesota follows what's called the Red Book, the highly pathogenic avian influenza book that's used across the United States. As far as the testing that needs to be done, whether or not the disinfecting is going according to plan, all of the testing on the premises to make sure there's no virus that remains. I think in answer to your question, it's going to be a case-by-case basis to make sure that no virus remains. We're hopeful that it will take a less amount of time rather than more, but it will be a case-by-case basis.
Thank you.
Yep. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. with the possibility of it being transferred by the wild bird population in their migratory patterns, are the migratory birds at risk, too? I mean, is there going to be a major breakout amongst the duck and possibly the goose population in this scenario?
Dr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I will answer to the extent of my knowledge, that might be a DNR question, Department of Natural Resources question. I do know that there are some of these viruses, not specifically H5N2, that have caused some die-off in waterfowl in years past in other parts of the world, but that's as far as my knowledge of that would go.
Okay. One final question. Then as far as this particular strain of the H5N2, is it a different strain of what originally years ago was referred to as the Asian bird flu at that point in time?
Dr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it is my understanding, and I would have to look specifically at which flu you were talking about, but yes, more than likely it is a different strain.
Okay. Mr. Cruz?
Mr. Chair, members, I did want to just highlight one thing. I think some of the questions that Senator Nelson was directing at human health were, I think, on a lot of people's radar and a lot of concern, and we thank you for those questions. One of the things that I've been asked by Commissioner Ellinger and Commissioner Fredrickson to highlight is that this is not a food safety concern. Though the exposure to the birds, as you heard from the Department of Health, they're being very, very cautious, and they've got that situation monitored very, very closely. From a food safety standpoint, there is no concern for really a lot of reasons. One, the virus itself spreads and kills the bird very, very quickly. Two, all birds are tested before they go into a processing plant to see if they're sick. And then three, poultry is not something anybody eats raw. And this particular disease, as I understand it, likes cold and wet circumstances, not just out in the environment, but cooking itself really to any temperature. My understanding is above 80 degrees would be enough to take care of it. So we currently at the Department of Ag, in our role as food safety agency, have no concerns, and that's been supported by Commissioner Ellinger at the Department of Health.
Thank you very much. Dr. Thompson, you talked a little earlier about trying to figure out how the disease is getting inside some of the facilities. Do we have any clues yet on how? A lot of times, I mean, at least, you know, down in my neck of the woods, we raise a lot more pigs, but even the few turkey farmers that we do have, they're very secure facilities with a lot of protocols in place. So just curious if we have any idea how the disease is getting into those buildings.
And Mr. Chair, I am a swine vet. So, yes, the biosecurity. But we look to the poultry industry, too, just like the swine industry, of having that good biosecurity. You know, initially we were thinking that somebody stepped in some fecal material before they walked into the barn, but with the number of cases now, and that was the reason why we brought in that team or requested that team from USDA to start taking a look at. And they're not only looking at Minnesota, they're looking across the United States.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Or Dean Ames, you've been waiting patiently too, so if you'd like to comment a little bit, we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Chair Sparks and committee members, for this opportunity to just provide a brief update on the University of Minnesota's role in dealing with the high path avian influenza disease crisis that our poultry producers are dealing with. The Veterinary College, the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences and Extension have all been involved, as have been specific centers like our Center for Animal Health and Food Safety, and as mentioned, the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, and also the facility in Willmar, the Mid-Central Research and Outreach Center. Unfortunately, our avian influenza experts are at a meeting in Georgia about avian influenza today, and so couldn't be here, and our diagnostic lab staff are busy running the tests that we've been talking about, so I will do my best. But the faculty at the university have been active in dealing with the issues around avian influenza by alerting the industry to the threat with producer and industry meetings, as well as our research lab at McRock, or the Mid-Central Research and Outreach Center, has been involved in helping farmers with environmental testing. Early on, our faculty initiated a communications group and a poultry veterinarian working group, and both have been holding regular meetings in light of the avian influenza introductions on the West Coast, and this was led by Dr. Carol Cardona. Faculty have also been very involved working with our industry and state and federal partners on communication plans and response plans. The Extension Service has been alerting industry to the clinical signs and have been distributing materials about the biosecurity initiatives that Dr. Thompson mentioned, both in written and verbal communications across all of poultry production, including work with the small poultry flocks and organic producers. And they're, I think, a good example to highlight of what I would refer to as Minnesota's collaborative nature is that for the last 10 years, the faculty have been working with USDA and the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Agriculture, as well as with the poultry industry, on developing what are referred to as business continuity plans for broilers, turkeys, and eggs. And as a result of these continuity plans, with adequate testing, market weight birds and eggs can move out of these control zones that have been referred to. So a huge benefit to the industry, so that that product can actually move out of those zones rather than not be allowed to move. And we do have our Raptor Center faculty also involved in wildlife surveillance, and they've also been communicating to the captive managed wildlife community, so zoos and nature centers, etc. And so just finish mentioning briefly about the work of the diagnostic lab. And as mentioned, it is the official lab of the Board of Animal Health, and so it is an accredited lab that can conduct the high path avian influenza tests. And so both for producers to receive indemnity payments, as well as for producers to be able to move product, as referred to in the business continuity plans, the lab is active running samples. And so they've had to gear up to extended hours 7 days a week. And last weekend they ran over 170 samples so that they could keep the product moving out of these control zones. So we are fortunate that it is one of the busier veterinary diagnostic labs in the nation, and so it does have 12 trained PCR technicians, the lab techs that run these tests, and so they were able to staff up to deal with this response. And based on what we're hearing from meetings with industry and our state agencies, we are starting to train in additional techs. Unfortunately, it takes at least 4 months to get them trained in. Then they have to go through a test with USDA, and we prefer to use our more experienced techs to run the high path avian influenza tests. So most of them have have all had over a year's experience to run these tests. And then I do want to highlight the work of Dr. Cardona, one of our poultry experts and an endowed chair at the college, the Pomeroy Endowed Chair, for her many media interviews that she's been part of, as well as Dr. Porter, who's our lead diagnostician in the diagnostic lab. So thanks for this opportunity. We stand ready to work with our partners in the state and federal agencies and in industry to help in any way we can.
Dean Ames, thank you very much. Thank you all for all you're doing. It sounds like we're moving in the right direction. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I was just going to really commend you on the fast and thorough response, and I thought I heard a couple of you actually mention that people are working on this, 12 hours a day, 7 hours a day, and I think it's that kind of response that is so necessary in a critical issues like this and things that are totally unplanned. I don't know that anybody knew on Easter Sunday that this is exactly what we would be facing. And I just want to know and ask a kind of a rhetorical question here, but what would happen if you had to have your scheduling out 21 days prior? In other words, you couldn't bring people in to do work if they didn't know it 21 days ahead of time. I think we heard that bill in this committee. So case in point, you're doing a great job, and I'm glad we don't have that predictive scheduling in place. I think it would be very damaging here.
Well, like the
Dean Ames.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Chair Sparks. Like the Department of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health, we're using overtime and extended hours in order to meet the demand. But we're very thankful that we have so many trained techs and that we have at least some ability. Many other labs have two or three of these technicians, and so really can't go beyond the standard hours of five days a week. So we are fortunate in that respect.
Thank you. No, I appreciate you guys being here, and I think you can just tell by the committee's questions that it's on all of our minds. So we're a policy division, but we do have your budget request, and certainly we'll share that with Senator Tomasoni, and he's going to unveil his bill in about a half an hour, and hopefully we'll have some money in there for rapid response for you too, Dean Ames. So thanks a lot for you guys being here. Any other questions for members, or would anyone else like to talk on this issue? If not, thank you very much. It was very informative.
Thank you, Chair members.
Yep. With that, members, we are adjourned.